Transmission start. Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Join us as we wander off the path and explore lost history, consciousness, the paranormal, unexplained mysteries, alternative thought, and much more. We are present on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now here is your host, Soraya.
Welcome to this edition of Where Did the Road Go? Tonight, we're going to be talking about the Christianization of Bigfoot, and we'll get into a little more of what that means when we actually start the conversation. I have with me Joshua Cutchin and Timothy Renner, and both of them have commented on this in the past. Timothy wanted to do a show on it, so, well, this is it. Next week, next Saturday to be exact, for those of you who listen on WVBR when the show first broadcasts, it's going to be a rare live show. We're going to have Peter Robbins in studio, and he's going to be bringing with him a friend of his who is an experiencer who's had some very weird experience and has a bunch of implants in her body. We're going to be talking to them live in the studio, so if you want to comment or anything or ask questions, you can go to wheredidtheroadgo.com while the show is airing on WVBR and send me messages through the website, and I will pass them along to Peter and his friend. I want to apologize for the lack of shows during the week. Hopefully that is going to be remedied very soon. I have one show with a movie producer that's going to be going up, a really interesting roundtable, and a couple of Patreon pieces that are going to be added up, hopefully all this coming week. The Patreon segment that will accompany this talks about Timothy's interesting encounter in the woods that happened to him just recently. And the one that accompanies the roundtable that will hopefully be up later this week, I'm not even sure I could put on a public forum due to some of the content. It's not that it's lewd or anything like that, but we get very in-depth into hallucinogens and reality and stuff like that, and it's quite a conversation. All right, if you want to help out, become a patron, $3 a month, www.wheredidtheroadgo.com. You get extra content and stuff, and yeah, without any further ado, here we go. All right, and I am here with Timothy Renner and Joshua Cutchin. And for this week's subject of the show, Tim, I'm going to let you get into this because it's something you brought to me and wanted to do a show on it, and I thought it was a great idea.
Okay. Let me start out by saying I do not have a problem with anyone's religion. This is not about anyone's religion. I have no problem with people of, you know, having spiritual belief. I think that's a great thing. But that said, I have noticed of late that there's a certain kind of, I don't know if it's an attempt to Christianize the Bigfoot thing. I don't know if that's a fair way to put it. And cryptids in general, but mainly I've noticed it with Bigfoot. But certainly an attempt to apply religious terminology to it. Maybe we'll put it that way.
Hmm. Okay.
Offended, Timothy.
And Josh, I believe you've actually brought up that same point before.
Specifically about Bigfoot or?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting because if you look at sort of there are very distinct demographics by and large for people who are interested in certain niches in the unexplained. And the Bigfoot, or rather should I say like sort of the Bigfooter in terms of people who like go around tromping through the forest, culture is very much, it's very much a sort of rural oriented demographic. Now, look, I mean, these are my people in a lot of ways. You know, the people that I, you know, my family and such. But I think that is part of what sort of feeds into what Tim is getting at, is that these are people who generally do come from a Christian background, and I think they sort of try to wedge the Bigfoot thing in there. You know, Tim, we hadn't really talked about this much off air, but were you specifically thinking about the Nephilim thing, or was there something else that you were
driving at as well? It comes from sort of there's sort of three forks to it. I think there is the Nephilim thing, which a lot of people believe that these creatures are Are they specifically Nephilim, or do they say they're offspring of the Nephilim? I'm not quite sure the what begat what there.
Yeah, I think the idea is that now my Old Testament knowledge is being exposed for what it is. As I understand it, the Nephilim are the offspring of the fallen angels who lay with the daughters of men.
Right, they're a hybrid between man and the fallen angels. Or right. Angels, or the Anunnaki, depending on which version you're looking at.
Were the Bigfoot then specifically Nephilim, or were they then like offspring of the Nephilim? I forget what the...
I've actually heard that both ways. I've heard it, you know, I mean, if you look at the word Nephilim, it's usually translated as like being giant. So I think that's part of why it gets pulled in a little bit. But I'm sure that there, I mean, you know, if you can think it, someone's already thought it up. I'm sure that there's at least some group of people out there who think that the anomalous giant skeletons across the U.S. were the Nephilim, and their children were the Bigfoot. Maybe there's some truth to it, because you know I think I remember hearing one time that there is a loose connection between Sasquatch and Native American burial mounds as well, which is where you generally have found these anomalous giant skeletons in the past.
Just
enough to make it interesting. You know, just enough that you can't write it off and dismiss it as completely, you know, impossible.
The other arm is where people they'll talk about the supernatural aspects of Bigfoot, and then they'll say it's a demon.
Yeah, or that I think an idea that sort of has that I think that you're sort of getting at too is the idea that that Sasquatch is sort of a man's form, but is an empty vessel for a demonic entity to inhabit. If it's so desired.
Yeah, I've heard that as well. And there's a sort of the flip side of that coin are the people who, because, you know, their religion dictates that they cannot deal with anything that is demonic or the occult, there's a whole other group of people that then furiously insist that this is an absolutely just a physical creature, ape in the woods, and you're completely, you know, insane if you bring any of this other stuff into it. Because they cannot have any, they can't be out in the woods searching for a demon, in other words, because that, you know, that would really be against the religion.
Right.
Right. That's an interesting angle that I hadn't thought of. I mean, like part of me, the people who are, I mean, because I constantly flip-flop back and forth on what I think the heck's going on. But part of me has always assumed that the people who insist on the flesh and blood Bigfoot thing are doing it because they have a real desire that they can somehow someday get to the bottom of what's going on. Which I think, if there's some sort of demonic or supernatural angle, you're never going to get to the bottom of. But that's an interesting angle, Tim, that I hadn't really thought of.
I think that's part of it. I think that's why there, in my mind, that's why so many people are so vehemently just against the idea that there could be any supernatural thing. They're holding on to it as a core belief. In other words, because they don't want that to conflict with some other essential core belief. Which would be their religion.
Yeah. And if you look a lot of the ways, I mean, not saying that every person who has, Bigfoot Christian related Bigfoot beliefs, which is a phrase I didn't think I'd say today. not to say that everybody who has Christian related or Bigfoot related Christian beliefs, is necessarily an evangelical, but if you look at sort of the evangelical culture, it's very much along the lines of, you know, don't even watch horror films, because if there's something demonic in a horror film, you're putting that idea in your head. That's sort of really extreme take on how the demonic oppression can sort of manifest in your own life, which I have honestly always thought was a bunch of hooey.
Right.
As a Christian, like I've been like, really? Can't you just enjoy it as a movie? You know?
Well, I don't know. That kind of makes sense to me. If you believe that stuff is genuinely real, that, you know, thinking about it might lead you towards it a little bit. And so if you're watching, you know, a movie about demons, potentially you're inviting that stuff in.
Yeah, I think sort of though, in a way that like, I don't know. To me, it's more along the lines of if you have a curiosity or something that's going to open this thing into your life, it's already there. It's not like the movie
probably
puts it in your life. Sort of like, you know, if you're primed for, you know, some sort of other transgressive act, you know, in the Christian church, watching something might spurn you on to do it, but it's not like that necessarily put the idea or anything into your head.
Yeah, it was there. It just needed a trigger.
Right, right.
And you're going to get that trigger sooner or later.
Yeah, in some form or fashion, absolutely. So do we want to sort of like break each of these apart? I mean, I think that might be a good way to do it. Just so the Nephilim thing, like I've talked to individuals of the Christian persuasion in the past, fellow Christians, and they have been, you know, in some ways I've gotten the impression that that's the way that they would prefer to deal with something like Bigfoot. I talked to one person who said that if he ever found Bigfoot, he was going to witness to Bigfoot. And I'm like, well, yeah, you go ahead and do that. Tell me how that goes.
Well, I think with all of this, and maybe this comes later in our discussion, but there's take the alien abduction phenomenon. A lot of people have said that this is they've drawn comparisons to, you know, incubi and succubi, which I think are apt comparisons. They're absolutely apt comparisons when you look at, you know, the medieval literature describing what's happening.
Undeniable comparisons, I think, in a lot of ways.
Yeah, absolutely. But if you look at this, and I think this probably applies to anything in the paranormal, if you're going to look to it to confirm your religious beliefs, I think it's really dangerous. Because I think it's going to probably confirm your beliefs no matter what they are. In other words, you can shape this stuff because it's so nebulous. You can fit it in kind of anywhere. You can jam it in. And I forget where I actually read about the study, but there was a study with the abduction phenomenon where they found that people were having great results with prayer and with using religious symbolism to stop this.
Was it Joe Jordan's work? Because he was just on Conspiranormal talking about this.
I'm not sure, I remember reading the article, and I remember just being like really interesting. The really interesting part is it really didn't matter what religion they were. Hmm. In other words, Christians had great success if they, you know, hung crosses on their bed, or Catholics with rosaries.
Right.
But Jewish people had a great success with the Star of David. Wiccans had a success with pentagrams, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It seems like belief is a part of this, but it doesn't necessarily matter what your belief is. And that's why I say I think it's really dangerous to sort of look to this to confirm your beliefs, because I think it will probably.
Yeah, yeah. And I've met people who have, you know, like with the abduction scenario, have said, well, I had these what seemed like sleep paralysis. They thought it might have been alien induced, and they would pray and it would stop. And so that drove them toward religion. And it's like, okay, well, that's fine, but I'm pretty sure no matter what you prayed to, if you believed in it, it would have worked.
Yeah. I think belief is tied in to all of this.
Yeah.
Somehow in ways that we probably don't quite understand.
See, now I would push back a bit on belief, because you specifically find a lot of indications of people who are atheists or who are non-believers in some certain situations who are motivated or who are called to call upon, usually in the stories that filter down through what I hear, you know, Jesus, especially in like near-death experiences, where on the rare occasions that people actually go to what they perceive as hell, they call upon Jesus and they're like half believing in it, but it still has some sort of power, which throws a little bit of a monkey wrench in the idea of, you know, oh, it's your own faith, you know, projecting through you. It implies that there's some sort of objective power in the names of holy figures, whatever they might be.
You know, at the same time, though, so many people are raised Christian in this country, for instance, that I think when you you know, you may say you're an atheist, but deep down you might still have those remnants of the way you were raised. So you get into that situation where this is frightening. I don't know what to do. I'm going to, you know, make this ditch effort and call out to the thing I believed as a child, and then it works. That might be part of a sort of unconscious belief that just never completely got erased. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's just sort of a vestigial thing that's sort of hung on and clung to their,
yeah,
clung deep down in their core forever. And that's entirely possible too.
So there are no atheists in foxholes, but depending where the foxholes are dug, you know what I'm saying?
It's, right, you know, right.
It's also possible that since this stuff interfaces with our consciousness, that it intentionally makes us think that those things work.
Okay, let's unpack that, because the idea that an objective other is sort of allowing us to think that that works. So yes. it's backing off as part of as another further step of the theater that it so often engages in.
Right. Because when you look at some of LA's work, when he talk, one of the things he talks about is as UFO phenomenon in particular, but he calls it a control system. And one of the things he gets into is how, like, it seemed, you know, like when you have the religious miracles, places like Fatima and stuff, and the connections there between the UFO phenomena and Fatima, you see it almost, you know, when you get the Blessed Virgin Mary apparitions and stuff, it seems to be trying to push us in that direction at times.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's one of my biggest problems about people talking about there being, you know, alien life of some sort, is that if there is some sort of one generalized answer, it's been very apparent from the start that the goal is to obfuscate and to make the actual origins of what's happening on the behalf of the phenomena. It's been very deliberately unclear. So I think that taking that one step further, you know, if there is some sort of other that allows itself to be mistaken for something that has some sort of cultural significance, if it helps to further their aims in terms of obscuring their motives and what they truly are, it makes sense. I had never really considered that.
Also, when we were talking about the Nephilim, the actual, and I was pretty sure about this, but I wanted to look it up. The Nephilim are, The name, at least when translated to English, means fallen ones, and it is the sons of God and human women who gave birth to the Nephilim. And I do believe that translates as Anunnaki if you go back far enough. And the Nephilim were supposed to be giants. They were supposed to be the heroes of old and the men of renown. And of course, you get the giants in many other cultures as, you know, heroes and so on and so forth. But it was fallen ones is what it translates to in English.
And I'll go out and say, if we get the solution to this mystery, which the older I get, the less I think that's going to happen in my lifetime, excuse me. And it's proven that they're Nephilim. I will say, okay, they're Nephilim. You know,
right.
We talked about this kind of thing before. I'm not saying I have the answers and these people are wrong. All right. I'm saying is I don't think anyone has the answer just yet. And to have an almost, ironically, a sort of religious kind of faith in knowing that, you know, what these things are is I think, until we know, it's getting ahead of things.
Well, and for me, you know, something that has always bugged me, and this is repeating some stuff that I said in a little appearance that I don't conspire normal, but the people who say that phenomena X or Y represents demonic activity, even if they say that the benevolent or positive manifestations of that activity represent angelic activity, there is still a vast spectrum of neutral behavior that happens in these cases.
Yeah.
If you're looking at Bigfoot, like, if the Joe, just using Joe Simonton, not that I think that's an ironclad case or anything, but like if the Joe Simonton case is okay, that's not negative and that's not positive. That's just a bunch of guys trading some, you know, pancakes for water. That doesn't seem especially demonic to me. And similarly, like if Bigfoot are the Nephilim, there are plenty of cases where, it hasn't acted like a demon. It's acted like a giant monkey. There are plenty of neutral cases that I don't think really are answered by that. Again, you know, there are plenty of high strange cases that would seem to suggest some sort of, you know, biblical answer, but there's also some stuff that seems just completely mundane that doesn't really fall within that answer.
So I know your expertise, Joshua, with the Fae folk. Now, they were, you know, obviously around before Christianity, just speaking in say the UK, Ireland, and so forth. They were sort of, when Christianity kind of moved in, they were looked at in various ways, most often though as evil. Yes.
Well, you'll hear a lot of different things. The two versions that I've really come into the most about, you know, trying to Christianize the Fae folk are that A, they were the angels that were too good for hell but too bad for heaven, and sort of a variation on that sometimes gets wound up in that is that when the gates of heaven were shut after the war between Satan and his followers, the angels who were shut out of heaven and out of hell fell to earth where they were, and that is why they're elemental spirits now. But really, what these are, and this is where I sort of go against, you know, mainstream Christianity in a big way, is that there's this completely reductive Judeo-Christian thing of this dichotomy of good or evil and nothing in between. And I personally think it makes more sense for there to be a robust sort of ecosystem of spirits that I think the Fae folk model satisfies in a very parsimonious way, personally for me. I think it's one of a couple of different possibilities that I've entertained. It's definitely the one that I'm most fond of. I like the idea of there being this sort of, I like the idea of there being free agents out there as opposed to, you know, everything's either an angel or a demon.
Sure.
I think that's probably a much more healthy way to look at it because the accounts bear it out. If we bring it back to Bigfoot, like you said, there's a lot of stuff that's just roadside crossings, you know, very, very neutral kind of things. Somebody sees something walking through the woods. Nothing incredibly, you know, aggressive or anything. And then you get the flip side where you get the flip side in both ways. You get people who say that, you know, the Sasquatch rescued me from a forest fire or something like this.
Exactly. Yeah.
And then the other kind where you have these really vicious attacks.
But how many vicious attacks are there really? It seems like that's a minority type of thing.
Well, Ape Canyon is the famous one. The Ape Canyon story about some loggers who shot a Bigfoot, and then supposedly their cabin was under siege.
Oh yeah,
from a bunch of Sasquatch. There are other anecdotes. There's a lot of posturing, I guess, is what I'm getting at. There's not a lot of cases that you hear where Bigfoot like smacks the crap out of somebody. There's a lot of posturing on Bigfoot's behalf, but not a lot of action, unless you assume that, you know, some stuff like missing 411 is the behavior of Bigfoot. But I think that's sort of a big leap to make.
If I may.
Yes,
there's
please.
This new book. It just came out. It's called Bigfoot in Pennsylvania. It's by this guy named Timothy Renner.
Like a pro. Look at that.
And there are several attacks documented in this book. Guerrilla attacks from Pennsylvania in the 1920s. Now, people were saying that they were seeing gorillas. Now, this is in the winter in Pennsylvania in, like I said, 1920, 21. And, you can almost track, if you read the articles, you can sort of almost track, I think it was probably more than one creature, but they seem to be moving across the state. It kind of starts outside of Pittsburgh, moves to the center of the state, comes down to the south. And amongst these articles are several reports of attacks. I don't know if it was just a particularly aggressive group or one single creature, but it attacked a 14-year-old boy and put him in critical condition. There's two or three different articles about it attacking cars as they drove by, and a couple more in there. So I mean, it happens probably, you know, at least
more often than I assumed, at least. Yeah.
Unless it's, like I said, maybe this is particularly, you know, outside of the realm of normal, but it seems like that I'm, you know, I've been able to find a few, at least in these old reports.
But it still seems like that's a minority type of thing. Like most Bigfoot encounters are simply people see it and then it disappears.
I think so. I think it's well in the minority. Most by far, I think, are, at least modern times, are roadside crossings. People just, you know, see something and that's that.
Yeah.
Or those wonderful Class B reports at the BFRO site, which are like, I smelled something and heard a wood knock, you know?
Yeah.
Which I don't think necessarily indicates Bigfoot to begin with.
You flipped me on that. I'm completely in your camp on that now. I hadn't thought about it in another way. And then when you said sounds like poltergeist activity.
Yep.
You flipped me. I'm on your team for that.
I appreciate it, man. It's not so much that I necessarily think that. It's just that is another obvious answer to me if you're looking at the whole spectrum of what we talk about and what we deal with. And, you know, I find it really fascinating that, and it's sort of a brief tangent for me because everybody knows that I have this fae folk axe to grind, but I find it astonishing how little people draw those Sasquatch fae folk comparisons. But I was doing some research just the other day and I found an ethnographic study of the Catawba Indians, legends on the wild people. Wild Indians is what they called them, which were their term for the little people, for the fae folk. And it was a very common thing among the Catawba Indians where they would go outside and find their horses' manes brayed, and the Catawba Indians would say, well, that's the wild Indians who did it, their version of the little people.
Yeah.
Which you hear with Celtic fae folklore, and you also hear with Bigfoot reports. You know, nowadays people see that in Bigfoot country, and they're like, oh, Bigfoot likes to mane horses, braid horses' manes. I've got my tongue is backwards tonight. It's really astonishing to me that there are these sort of through lines that people don't address. Again, another thing that's really interesting is the ghillie suits that people wear, that military men wear, are named ghillie suits because they're named after the Irish ghillie dubh, which was a solitary fae folk who was tall and shaggy. And this, you know, this connection is so strong that a lot of the Australian infantry actually call them yowie suits instead of ghillie suit because of the resemblance to the yowie. So there are all these little connections between Bigfoot and fae folk that people don't ever really make because they're too busy thinking about these Victorian ideals of, you know, these little tiny winged spirits flitting around. They don't realize that the idea of fae folk is actually like this giant spectrum of phenomena, almost like that sort of goblin universe idea that was talked about.
Yeah, there's... speaking of hair braiding, I meant to mention this to you, Joshua. I saw you talking about that. There's a creature from the Long Lost Friend is a sort of folk magic book of the Pennsylvania Dutch.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there's an entity in there. It's mentioned. It's a Trotterhead. And I did some research on it with help of a German friend, and it comes from a sort of group of these entities known in various things. They're basically nightmares, the things that bring nightmares. And one of the aspects of them was to braid the manes of horses.
Huh.
Interesting. Interesting with the whole nightmare thing, because wasn't the idea that there's some sort of horse connection with nightmare as well, isn't there?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So I wonder if that sort of ties into it too. Interesting. Yeah, that's just such a weird, and who knows, like maybe there's some sort of undocumented phenomena that happens in stables where horses' manes are likely to become, you know, wound up on themselves. But that seems kind of unlikely to me.
I mean, they're known as witches knots. Yeah, just if you ask just people who raise horses, they've always, you know, they call them witch knots when the horses get that. And they'll tell you they come from the wind and so forth, but they're still known as witch knots.
That's right. I think I've heard that too. Yeah, it's so strange.
Okay. Well, there's so many weird connections when you look back through this stuff. And I don't think those connections give us answers, but they show us how the depth of this type of stuff.
Yeah, I think it's important to note them, even if they're coincidences. In the same way, I'd like to note, you know, like the strange lights happening in the same places as Bigfoot sightings.
Right. Well, you know, poltergeists.
Well, yeah, I mean, I've often said that you need to look at the company that these things keep, because it seems, I mean, even if it is coincidental that you have these sort of window areas where a lot of different phenomena manifest themselves, it still seems like there might be some sort of shared mechanism that draws these things to the place. And who knows, therein might be the answer to a lot of these things.
Well, that's true too. You know, because there are definitely window areas for whatever that means.
And we're talking about cross-cultural phenomenon.
Yeah.
So
Right.
These things, it's been said before, this is nothing new, but people have been seeing, you know, hairy things that live in the woods next to them since we've been keeping records of any kind.
Yeah. You know,
there's always some kind of big, giant, hairy, bipedal thing that lives just outside of our lights, with our lights are, you know, LED or just some, you know, primitive campfire.
Well, you can say the same thing about little people. I mean, there's little people in pretty much every culture.
And I don't think it's too far of a stretch to suggest that perhaps these are sort of ancestral memory. Of course, ancestral memory sort of is one of those paradigm shattering things that isn't supposed to exist anyway. But, you know, if the out of Africa hypothesis is true, and there's plenty of people who have argued otherwise, but if the out of Africa hypothesis is true, then it would make sense that we would have these sort of legends about being terrified of these hairy monsters on the edge of town. You know, it would make sense that, you know, if there is some sort of migration out of that sort of Sundaland area that would become Indonesia, that perhaps we had some sort of memory of, you know, Homo floresiensis, stealing babies and replacing them with their own or something. You know, I think that's a valid angle that hasn't gotten enough attention.
Have you ever read the book called Them and Us?
No, I've seen the artwork, which is like some of the most wonderfully terrifying stuff I've ever seen. I bring it up every now and then, but I didn't read the book. But isn't the hypothesis that Neanderthals were smarter than we realize, but also uglier and less human appearing than we realize?
Well, the overall notion of the book is basically that it's Neanderthal predation, that they were preying on us, on humans, and abducting our women to mate with them. And that the author kind of goes and sort of expands upon it and basically almost uses the theory to explain every modern trait of humans. I think he goes a little too far. But, and I do mention this in my new book, I think that even if it happened a little bit, even if it didn't happen as much as he says, he goes into where he thinks they hunted modern humans almost to extinction. There's like a population bottleneck at some point when modern humans move into the Middle East, and he thinks basically that's where we were hunted almost to extinction by Neanderthal.
That's really fascinating. And you know what? I mean, it makes a lot of sense in a lot of ways. I mean, I've often heard the idea that a dragon represents some of our most archaic fears. You know, the reptilian fear of you know, of like large lizards, large monitor lizards, goannas, crocodiles, etc. And then also the avian aspect, this sort of death from above, you know, like larger eagles, like you would don't necessarily have today, but like harpy eagles could definitely be like a threat to small children and such.
Sure.
And if you look at some of the research, I think this has actually come up on this show a couple times, and if not, it's come up somewhere else, because I'm pretty sure I've said it, but there have been studies that have taken several generations of chickens and raise them in a lab, you know, to the extent of, I believe, two or three generations. And they have passed a silhouette of a hawk above them, and the chicks scatter, even though they're several generations removed from ever actually being in a barnyard.
Yeah.
So, you know, there is something we as carbon-based life forms are not blank slates when we enter this reality. There's some programming here,
whether it be genetic memory or like whatchamacallit proposed, the morphogenic fields.
Rupert Sheldrake.
Thank you. You know, one of those things would potentially explain that.
Right, and that's what I was getting at. Even if maybe it didn't happen as much as the author of Them and Us, I'll butcher his name. It's Danny Vendramini, I believe. Even if it didn't happen as much as he said, but it happened some, I think that's a really worthy genetic memory to pass down. If something's, you know, going to hunt you, eat you, and abduct your women, that's a fairly significant memory to pass down. And maybe it wasn't even Neanderthals, or maybe it was Neanderthal and some other relic hominid, you know?
Yeah.
That's sort of what I was, you know, maybe it was Neanderthal and the hobbits. You know, and that's why we have this Bigfoot little people sort of thing that has pestered us throughout every culture.
Yeah. Now, all of that said, whatever this something is, I do believe people are seeing it. I do believe it leaves footprints, hair, and scat behind. I do believe it leaves strange structures in the woods. I believe it attacks livestock and pets. And on rare cases, I believe it abducts humans. So,
yeah, what do we
do with that?
I would second all of that. Well, this is where people push up their glasses and say, well, what if it was a tulpa? Well, you know, I mean that's possible, but to me tulpa is becoming sort of that worst thing of using one unexplained thing to explain another thing.
Yes.
It's become like, and don't get me wrong, like I do that sometimes as well. Oh, but you know, Bigfoot's one of the faithful. I do that sort of thing a lot, but to me, the tulpa thing is like taking something and making it even loosey goosier than the original question that you had. You know, it's making it even more intangible to me in some sort of way. I think there's something to it, but I don't necessarily think it's the answer like everybody wants to trot out nowadays.
Well, I mean, and that's how the whole interdimensional thing got to be. You know, I mean, Keel proposed it early on, and it was a novel, interesting idea. And then after a while, there were a lot of people who were just like, oh, it's just interdimensional. It's like, we don't even know if there are other dimensions. I mean, we can speculate about them, but we can't prove it. So it doesn't answer it because we don't know if that's a real thing. And tulpas fall into that category. I mean, if we could absolutely prove that tulpas were a real thing, then we might have something to work with. And it's definitely a possibility to help explain the phenomena, but until we can absolutely prove that such a thing exists, it's just an idea.
Yeah, and I misspoke on a recent on the Paramania Radio Misterioso episode. I said that the only time that you really saw tulpa mentioned in sort of Western ethnography was in the Alexander David Neal, the famous anecdote of hers. Without realizing that my hero Evans Wentz had actually done a transcription of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and I'd actually mentioned it in there as well. I'm still convinced that the concept, from what I've seen, I'm still convinced that the concept is not as fleshed out as a lot of people would have you believe. You know, you hear a lot of word of mouth with people talking to British Buddhist mystics about the concept, but you don't see a lot of ethnographic scholarship on it, which I find sort of a curious hole in the literature.
All right. Okay. We kind of moved away from the idea of Christianizing this stuff, but that's all right.
We're Buddhaizing it.
What were the other aspects there we were going to deal with? Oh, the idea that this was demonic and or it's flesh and blood because we don't because people don't want to feel that it's demonic or evil or something.
Yeah, I think for the strict the very strict maybe evangelistic Christian. I don't want to speak for people. I don't want to seem like I'm attacking anybody because I think belief is a good thing. I also think that I would be concerned to make any of the aspect of the paranormal, Bigfoot included, part of my faith, just because I think it's gonna be very weird. You know, the very weird things happen, and I don't think I think you're getting into dangerous territory. But hey. You know, what can you do?
At that point, you're just sort of, you're almost using it to prop up your own belief. You know, you're almost using it as sort of a faith spackle, you know?
Yeah. And again, I allow that, you know, maybe I could be wrong. Maybe they could be right. But I think a lot of people have claimed to have the answers before, and this stuff always twists at the end, you know?
Yeah.
If you go to Mothman prophecies, that was twisted all over the place. They thought they had their thumb on it. They thought these things were given, you know, accurate predictions, but some of the predictions would come true and some not, you know?
And the big one, of course, failed.
Okay. Sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, that's one thing that I know Chris O'Brien has talked about a lot is that, you know, as soon as you notice a trend, you'll notice it repeating itself. But as soon as you actually like talk about it publicly, it'll go ahead and reverse itself on
you.
Classic trickster behavior.
And again, it plays with that whole interface of consciousness. What is the phenomena trying to do? You know, like, is it trying to trick us? Is it trying to keep us open-minded? Is it that we can't possibly conceive of what it is, so it's trying to show us all the things it's not, you know?
Well, I mean, I would suggest that perhaps maybe it's like the bit of sand that gets stuck in the oyster, you know, that turns into a pearl. It's just sort of a catalyst. This is sort of, you know, a variation on the Jacques Vallée control mechanism, but it's just sort of, it functions, it's sort of a catalyst for growth, maybe. Personal growth or growth as a species or whatever. Yeah, maybe. I mean, one way or the other, that's a possibility, I think.
Which could be, I mean, that could be a very interesting way to the idea that it's confirming belief in general. In other words, telling people that, hey, you know, have a spiritual path, but not necessarily confirming the right one for them. Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, if you look at, you know, whenever people have the greatest possible, well, anybody or anything, the greatest possibility for growth is when things are unstable.
Yes.
You know, we want our triangle to be along one of the edges, but if the triangle of life is sitting on its point, you know, it's unstable, but there's the most room to go in one direction or another direction drastically.
And so much of this stuff also, as we've discussed with Jeff Ritzman numerous times, happens at points of change and disruption in life. And I wonder if anyone's looked at the Bigfoot phenomena in that way. I mean, obviously Jeff has done it with UFOs and stuff, but I wonder if anyone's taken these Bigfoot accounts and done that sort of research, like what was going on in these people's lives when they had encounters.
I think that the cryptozoological community is pretty resistant to that sort of idea. I mean, we you know, my group of fellow punk rock ufologists are always, you know, lamenting the fact that ufology doesn't want to, you know, take a leap into the weirder or more, you know, symbolic thematic stuff. But cryptozoology keeps that at even more arm's length, I think. Wouldn't you agree, Tim?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's very resistant to that. And I believe you said this on when you were on my show. You know, there have been some actual, you know, legitimate discoveries made by cryptozoologists of creatures that at one time people said, you know, didn't exist. So I understand there's that sort of like kernel of hope there, you know, that
yeah, that's an excellent point, because I too often go to the other extreme and say that we need to, you know, we need to be more open to these sort of odd fringy ideas. But the reality of it is the fact that, you know, every Fortean discipline should have cryptozoology envy, really. I mean, it's the only field that has actually made legitimate strides. I mean, there's an entirely unsexy side to cryptozoology that nobody ever talks about. The sort of stuff that Carl Schuker writes about. I have a book of his. It's a great book. It's like, again, it's not very sexy, but it's a great book about, like, you know, they rediscovered this species of toad and it's fascinating. Or like, you know, this particular species was only known from, you know, samples that people had obtained in markets in Mongolia. And now they've actually obtained a live specimen. So, I mean, it's the only sort of field of this type that has made any sort of really concrete strides. And we should always remember that. And, you know, we should also remember the fact that the physical evidence left behind by Sasquatch, you know, absolutely kicks the tail out of what, you know, what's left behind in the UFO phenomena. Don't talk to me about slag. Don't talk to me about burn marks on the ground. Don't talk to me about crop circles. This is stuff. This is a cast of something that's very tangible. These are hairs that, you know, we can go down the reason that, you know, hair hasn't proven Sasquatch. That's a whole other thing. But there have been anomalous hairs found. There has been anomalous scat found, you know, anomalous stick structures, recordings. Like, these things are all head and shoulders above what ufology has been able to produce, honestly, if I'm being honest at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And a little more definitive too. I mean, it's not like you're getting a scale off of a lizard alien. You know, you're getting burn marks on the ground, which could equally be caused by plasma as well as it could.
Or siphonum. Ship.
Right. You know? Right.
Yeah. So having said all that, I think it's interesting that what Tim had mentioned about the roadside crossings, because, I mean, travel is a liminal time, you know, travel is a liminal time.
Yeah.
Or it's a liminal space. You know, you're not at your destination yet. You're not where you started. You're in transit. So it is one of the sort of liminal, moments, you know. Oftentimes these roads, you know, there's a forest's edge at the road, you know, before the forest stops and there's a road, you know, and then the forest begins again. It's also a transitional space that you see this creature passing. And I don't think that gets talked about long enough at all.
Well, because I don't think people look at it that way.
No.
And anytime someone throws demon into the equation, it's another one like Tulpa. You know, that's a belief. People believe there are demons. We have absolutely no proof there are demons. You know, it just becomes this explains it.
Yeah, it's one of these sort of dangerous catch-alls. Like, you know, when I say, I often say, be careful, because we have a childish idea, I think, of what demons are. And that's not, I'm not saying the Bible's wrong. I'm not saying anybody's, I'm just saying, I think, whatever they are, whatever that phenomenon is, if they're real, it goes much deeper than a guy with a pitchfork or something, you know.
And you got the deeper concept of daemon as opposed to demon,
right?
Which is a very different thing.
Although sometimes I wonder if that wasn't just sort of like an etymological shortcut. It wasn't just sort of them sort of taking a general idea. I mean, I don't.
What do you mean?
In other words, instead of Christianity corrupting that concept, which is the way that it's usually presented, sometimes I wonder if they weren't like, oh yeah, a third party that controls your being. That's what, yeah, demon. Yeah, that's the same thing. And it's almost like sort of a more innocent thing as opposed to a direct co-opting of that concept.
Gotcha. Well, it's a possibility. I mean, you figure Christianity does have a sort of a history of co-opting other people's stuff.
Very good at that. They were excellent.
Yeah, it's almost the religion of syncretism syncretism. I'm using that word right. Syncretic. Yeah, syncretism.
I mean, every Christian holiday was initially a pagan holiday.
Right.
You know, it's just so the idea that they could have just taken this term and turned it into something else. Sure, why not?
Yeah, the straight up demonic Bigfoot thing has never really resonated with me in any way. Personally, what about you, Tim?
No, because I feel like you said, I feel like there's a spectrum, and I feel like if you catch, you know, a grizzly bear on a bad day, he's going to seem pretty demonic.
Exactly. If you catch me on a bad day, I'm going to seem pretty demonic.
Yeah, you catch the claw and tooth end of a bear, you're going to, you know, wow, he was pretty demonic. But I don't necessarily think that that's the case. I don't think it was possessed by any evil spirit to attack you. I think it was just, you know, a bad day for being around a bear.
But isn't there a school of thought too that these are like demonic manifestations?
I think that there's it ranges the gamut from, like Josh was saying earlier, like they're empty shells that it's just easy for demons to possess because there's no soul in there to take over. They just pop in and take over to, you know, these are literally demonic creatures, you know, that manifest on Earth. You know, it runs the gamut, I believe.
And I would say if these things were demonic, we would probably have more horrible stories than we do.
And I think they would, I mean, what's the end game?
Yeah. Well, yeah.
You know, with that, I guess some people say we're approaching the end times and that's why people are seeing more of them. So is there an army of Bigfoot coming? Do we need to, arm up here? You know, what's the end game?
Even the story that Joshua cited there about the people being terrorized in their cabin supposedly came about because they shot a Bigfoot.
Right, exactly.
So that
was retaliatory.
Yeah, that doesn't come across as, oh, these things are evil and out to get these guys. It's no, these things are angry because they killed their compatriot.
The kid I mentioned from my book had shot one 2 weeks before. And the theory was, even at the time, they said in the article, the theory was it followed him home and waited till it just bided its time till it could get a hold of that kid again. Huh. So yeah, it was a very much a sort of revenge kind of thing.
And to me, that doesn't strike me as evil as much as what, you know, anyone would do.
Chimps act very similar to that.
Yeah.
Chimps can be real vengeful you know, they have long memories.
And you know what? Something that amazes me with all the sort of talk of demonic Bigfoot that nobody ever talks about. If someone walked into a forest and saw a deer with glowing red eyes and it looked at them and said, "My name is Al-Zul and I have come to take your soul," no one would say that all deer are demonic.
Well, that's true, know? Too.
They would say this demon took the form of a deer. This demon took the form of something that is mundane, that's in the woods. And used it to sort of, you know, perambulate the earth and to sort of confront me. So why do we assume that if we see a Sasquatch that all Sasquatch would be demonic? You know, it doesn't really quite follow for me. It doesn't track.
And to be fair, I think there are a lot of people who say that not all of them are. You know, you know, devil's advocate, they'll say, again, it's back to the, you know, they're empty shells, so some can be possessed by demons.
Right,
some
aren't. Right. Yeah, that's true too.
I've even heard people go so far as to say when they have glowing red eyes, they're demonic. When they, the eyes glow another color, they're not. I mean, it's
that's an old Keel rule of thumb. Keel used to think that if he was sort of angling in some of his later books at the idea that if an entity had glowing eyes, it actually represented something paranormal as opposed to something with non-glowing eyes that represented something a bit more organic. That was something that he was sort of angling towards later in his life.
Which paranormal or demonic? I mean, specifically, because these people are just saying, like, if you see red, it's demonic. If it's glowing, you know, yellow or some other color, green, it's not demonic.
It's Cthulian if it's green.
It's like a mood ring.
right. Or stoplight. You know.
Keel was so ahead of his time with so much of this stuff.
Oh, yeah.
He really was. He was, I still don't think we've unpacked in any serious in-depth way a lot of his ideas. I think a lot of people go, oh, that's cool. You know, that might be something. And they throw around some of his ideas without like really unpacking them. And I, you know, include myself in that too.
Yeah. I know enough, Keel to get me in trouble, but, you know, I'm familiar with Mothman Prophecies and a few of his other writings. And they are gifts that keep on giving.
Well, look, when you look at like the Eighth Tower, which was released as something else in the US, I forget what it was, but I mean, that book there talks about, you know, the way these things seem to come in from the infrared.
Was it UFOs in the super spectrum, I think?
No. It was something much, much blander when it was released in the US. Let's see if I can find it here. It helps if I spell it right. The eighth grower does not work.
Okay, so apparently there was a subtitle of the Eighth Tower that was on ultra-terrestrials and the super spectrum. So that's part of where I got that from, I think.
Because I know I had been like, oh, what's this book? And then I was like, oh, it's the Eighth Tower under a different name.
And I actually saw that earlier and I can't remember. Welcome to Googling Live with Where Did The Road Go?
Well, anyway, I mean, but that stuff he talks about in there, like some of the patterns and watching this stuff come in from the infrared, how it goes for, you get that sort of purplish, you know, the UFO appears and it's kind of purple and then it's kind of, you know, it kind of goes in and out through that sort of a spectrum. And pretty much no one else touched that, you know, like,
nor has since, you know?
Yeah. It's like, you know, some people, you know, like us, will sit here and say, yeah, that's really interesting. And he's probably onto something. But most UFO researchers are like, well, what does that have to do with anything?
Yeah. How do the structured craft do that? You know?
Or why? Why would it?
Yeah. Why would the aliens do that, Sarai?
And again, early on, him and Valet, you know, everyone talks about how ahead of, you know, how Valet, you know, did all this stuff, and there's no argument about that, but, you know, Keel was right there with him proposing that these things were not necessarily extraterrestrial.
Yeah, the thing about Valet that I think he gets a lot of credit for, and rightly so, is that he was willing to take a more meta look at it.
Yes.
I think he was willing to step back and sort of question reality in a way that I think Keel never really, really fully engaged with. If that's a fair thing to say.
Yeah. I think Keel though had sort of a very straightforward way of looking at things. If that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think in a lot of ways he's the perfect complement to Keel in that sense.
And ironically, Keel considered himself a demonologist. He thought this stuff was negative, not necessarily in the demonic Christian sense, but he thought whatever was behind this phenomenon did not have our best interests at heart.
Yeah, I've seen some sort of later interviews with them where different researchers and stuff would sort of talk to him, and he was kind of like, why do you even want to look into this stuff? Like, why?
Yeah. It was, he fully believed that this was a negative phenomena.
Well, and there is this aspect of people dying untimely deaths or having, you know, spates of bad luck who look into this sort of thing.
Oh, absolutely. I believe Nick Redfern has a whole book on UFO people who research UFOs dying in weird ways.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the reason I keep frankincense on hand. Let's put it that way.
All right. Well,
so one more thing that we didn't really mention. We have time, or we?
Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead.
Is and maybe this is me looking at things too black and white, so I'm going to bring it up. You know, you guys let me know. I noticed that some of the same people who are, you know, willing to like look at this through a Christian lens will often use Native American mythology and folklore to back up their beliefs on these things. Now it's kind of like you're using two different playbooks there, right? I mean, am I wrong to kind of say like, you know, I like blurring the lines is good if you're not saying it's definitely one thing or the other. But when they do that, that always kind of confuses me too. Like, okay, so you're saying that the Bible says, you know, this and this, and these things are demonic, but you're going to go ahead and go to this other belief system and use it to back up your point. It just seems right. a little odd to me. It like using Greek myths, you know, a tale about Zeus to back up something from the Bible. Yeah.
Right.
Well, I mean, you don't think maybe they're just sort of trying to do that mini hands on the elephant sort of thing. Do you like, you know, trying to say, you know, everyone is seeing the same thing, but different parts of it. So
it could be
the Greeks, for example, in the example you gave, the Greeks are trying to describe, you know, the Christian truth. They just didn't realize what they were getting at. Is that what, you know?
It very much could be that, and you know, I would allow for that. I'm looking at it from, you know, from outside of that way, you know, and to me, it just seems incongruent. But maybe that's the case. If so, that would explain it.
So yeah. but kind of what you're saying is that, you know, they're taking this strict hard line on, you know, of this Christian view of the world, but then, oh, this piece fits with what we believe, so we'll allow that in, but we're not going to allow other pieces in because they don't fit.
Yeah, yeah. This Native American tradition says that they're demons or whatever the equivalent would be. So see, they're demonic. But that Native American tradition probably also says about 10 other things that you wouldn't believe in, and then you would say, go against your beliefs.
Right. Right. Yeah. But that's a typical human thing. You know, it's the way we kind of separate out the things that fit what we want to believe. And there's certainly plenty of that when it comes to the paranormal.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, hence the, you know, how well the extraterrestrial idea has gone. If you only look at the stuff you agree with, you're not going to get very far.
Yeah, that's very true. And, you know, I personally have tried to make it sort of a credo of mine to constantly challenge my beliefs. I find myself every now and then, and I feel like I'm in one of those periods again right now, where I find myself becoming really entrenched and really cheerleading one viewpoint. And I hope that, you know, I hope every time I listen to a podcast that I can find something that is compelling enough that it'll put a crack in that particular paradigm that I have, you know.
And again, I mean, to sort of go back on what I was just saying, I think I'm talking about, I'm looking for congruency at the same time in a topic where I'm saying that, you know, as soon as you think you have something congruent, then it'll shift and change. So.
Yeah. I think until we know what it is, all viewpoints are valid. Unless we can prove one is not one way or the other. And until we know what some of this stuff really is. And I mean, I don't mean, hey, I believe it's a physical creature or I believe it's a demon. I mean, actually have a physical Bigfoot to prove that it's, you know, a physical thing or something to that element. Until we can do that, all options have to be on the table.
I think that, to me, that's the logical approach. I don't see, I mean, I can't tell you what it is. If you ask me what it is, I cannot tell you. Speaking of Bigfoot specifically, I cannot tell you what it is.
There was was it last week's episode of Doctor Who? I don't know. His companion asked him something and he said, some people say they have the answers. And then he paused and went, and those people are idiots. And I thought, oh, how perfect for the world of the paranormal.
Yeah. I think we have to be willing to accept that we may never get the answers. And I personally believe we probably will never get the answers. And I think it's very important to sort of accept that we're going to be interested in this. I find it incredibly interesting. Obviously, I wouldn't be pursuing it if I didn't. Right. But you have to sort of accept that the puzzle is not going to be solved. You know, we might get to look at the puzzle at a different angle. We might get to, very, very few of us might be lucky enough to lay in a piece of the puzzle, but it's not going to be solved.
And I think it might be something that actually helps us move forward. And, you know, as Whitley Strieber once said, it may be, you know, the force of evolution itself. So it's always a step ahead of us because we can never catch up with it.
Since we rarely get to talk about Bigfoot on here, let's just go ahead and go through the pro kill question. So pro kill or anti kill?
Oh, I would definitely be anti kill. I mean, I understand the point, but is proving the reality of Bigfoot enough to be willing to take one of their lives?
Well, okay, so, but here's the thing. I don't think that you're invested in proving it or not. What I get upset with is when there are people who really want to prove it, but are still anti-kill. And I'm like, really? Because that's never going to happen.
Yeah, no one's going to believe any photograph.
Well, it also illustrates a naivete in terms of how like tranquilizers work, because too much you kill it anyway, too little you just make it angry and a little bit groggy. So unless you're going to have some sort of elaborate like Scooby-Doo Bigfoot cage, you're never going to capture a live Bigfoot. I mean, it's not going to happen.
I do not worry about like that. Someone talked about that show Killing Bigfoot, and I just laughed. They can go every day out there with all the firepower they can muster, and they're never going to kill one. I I know a lot of people say they have been killed, and the government took the bodies and right. this and that. Maybe, but I don't know. I think you could go out every day with a gun, and even if you did pop a shot off at one, you're not gonna. It's whatever happens is not gonna. It's not gonna drop like a regular animal, you know.
Yeah. Well, there have been cases where people have shot at Bigfoot and nothing has happened. The thing just absorbs it like it's not even bothered by it.
Plenty of cases.
Yeah, there's at least one, if not two, I think in my book, just from these old articles, people talking about shooting it to no effect.
Hmm. And that says something too. I mean, sure, it's a big animal, but you know, it suggests that it may not simply be an animal.
Yeah. Same thing with Dogman. These people talk about like putting multiple rounds in the torso of these Dogman creatures, and they just keep coming like nothing.
Yeah, I refuse to believe that you would need an elephant gun to see some sort of result from shooting a Bigfoot. Because that's, you hear a lot of people talking about, they're like, well, if I shot five rounds into an elephant, well, it's not an elephant, but people shoot these things and they don't even seem to flinch. They just keep on doing their own thing. It's not like they stutter or anything.
Yeah.
Was it the Stan Gordon, the famous Stan Gordon case where
I was just about just about to bring that up. That's one of my favorite cases.
Yep. Yeah, it's a great case. It has so many of these like weird commonalities that you run into in the paranormal. So like, there's this giant UFO. There are these two Bigfoots that like swat away some bullets that have been shot at them with tracer rounds and disappear. There's a smell of sulfur involved at one point. There's like a demonic possession at one point, and there's like the sound of a baby crying at one point, which is another one of those weird things that nobody talks about. That's a commonality in these experiences. And like it's like your grab bag of paranormal. I love that case so much.
I met Stan at the Butler Paranormal Conference. I guess it's about a month back now. That's the first thing. He like shook his hand. Stan, I love your work. Big fan. Bam, went right into talking about that. Like had to talk about that one. Love that encounter. I love it. And he said somewhere that he has tape, like audio tape of the witness, the fellow who shot it. I think he was a young guy at the time.
Digitize that stat, man. Yeah, right.
Yeah, like, and I understand like that fellow's dead. He died. At some point, I think in the 2000s, early 2000s or the 1990s. So I'm going to Stan's supposed to come on Strange Familiars. I'm going to kind of lean on him pretty heavily, like to see if we can get some of that audio
Nice. All right. Well, let's wind this up. Obviously, very appropriately, you have a new book out about this type of stuff, Tim.
Bigfoot in Pennsylvania. It's not really about the Christian question.
It's about Bigfoot.
Yeah. This is just about this is just encounters, just old newspaper encounters from 1838 until it goes up into the 1920s. That I dug up, and there's quite a lot of them, and they range from the little people accounts to they called them wild men in the 1800s. When you get around 1900, people become aware of the mountain gorilla through various, you know, they've either seen them in zoos or they've seen them in newspapers. So they start calling them gorillas around 1900. You see a shift, and it's interesting because there'll be escaped lunatics in up until about 1890. And then around 1895, 1900 or so, they start becoming gorillas escaped from zoos, which, you know, there must have been dozens of escaped gorillas. And there weren't even that many gorillas in the United States at that time. So it's very interesting. Just a number of these accounts, and it's quite a lot of them. There's some other books that have presented sort of these historical Bigfoot articles, and I did not expect to find enough to fill a whole book on Pennsylvania, but I found a ton of them. So there's probably the first in a series. I'll probably go and do Bigfoot in the Virginias and the Carolinas and et cetera, after this.
All right. And nice. Josh, you're part of a compilation that just came out.
It's coming out. If not out before then, it will be out by May 29th. UFOs Reframing the Debate. Featuring several recurring Where Did the Road Go guests, myself, Red Pill Junkie, and Greg Bishop as well. It's gonna be a fun time. In addition to the three of us, we also have MJ Benias, Robert Brandstetter, Jack Brewer, Mike Cleland, who's also another recurring Where Did the Road Go guest. Kirk Collins, Lauren Cutts, Susan Demeter St. Clair, Micah Hanks, Miles Lewis, Chris Rutkowski, and Ryan Sprague.
Nice.
I think Robbie's already getting hate mail about it. It's edited by Robbie Graham, and it's definitely one of these. I think one of the pull quotes that we got back was, "I'm sure to delight and offend you," because it's sort of a confrontational. Way of, you know, it's, I think the idea of it is to get people to rethink the way that they think about UFOs. So it's going to be, it's an honor to have been a part of this project, and we're really looking forward to seeing how it's received for ill or for better.
All right. And, Tim, people can find you where?
Strangefamiliars.com.
And Josh?
JoshuaCutchin.com, and right here on Where Did the Road Go.
Awesome. Thanks, guys.
Pleasure.
All right. And to take you out tonight, we're going to hear Timothy's band, Stone Breath. And we're going to hear a track called Styx off his album Cryptids, because it's just quite appropriate. See you next time.
Strange.